we've got left here. I know we started a bit late, so I won't go too long here. But I mentioned today in the letter that this week here we're finishing up with the Olympic Games. I don't know how many of you have watched. I enjoy that. Stayed up a little bit late at night sometimes to watch some of those. But being an old sportsman myself, I do enjoy watching some of the competitions because many of these athletes, you know, train for years. And you saw some interesting things that took place. You know, you saw some you know, good things, some sad things. It's called, I think, ABC Sports calls it the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat, and defeat too if you're running a long way. But you know, there's a lot of lessons to be learned. And, you know, even the Apostle Paul mentioned things that those games were taking place in his time. I mentioned in looking it up, the earliest recorded Olympic competition occurred in 776 BC. That's a long time. That's before Christ was born. These things were taking place all during those times. So obviously, people were aware of these games that were taking place. Now, it's interesting that it only had one event at the time. It was called the One Stade, S-T-A-D-E, and it was about a 200-meter race that was run, and that began the first Olympiad, which the four-year period by which the Greeks recorded their history. So this goes back a long time. And yeah, there might be no doubt paganism involved with it and things that, you know, they don't necessarily have now. It's basically sports competitions of all different kinds of sports. And so we watched some of these things. In fact, they had mentioned about the Jamaican that they call the fastest man on earth. Think about that for a minute. Is that really true? If you add on to it a little bit, you would say the fastest man in the 100 meter and the fastest man in the 200 meter. But he's not the fastest man in the 400 meter. He's not the fastest man in the mile. So it's interesting sometimes how they plug these phrases when you think about the fastest man in the world. Well, in one of those short sprints, yes, he is. But others have won different competitions because they have different abilities and their bodies are built maybe in different ways. You saw the one, again, the third, I believe the third or fourth Olympiad, that our swimmer from the U.S. once again had won all these awards. And I noticed in one of his races that he was supposed to win, he didn't win it. And it was just by maybe 1/100th because he didn't reach out like the Frenchman did. And, you know, 4 years ago, if you remember, we beat the French because this man came and just by the touch, we won the gold medal. So that's why if you look back even what Solomon said, the race isn't always to the swift. It's not always to the fastest guy, is it? And so we see different examples of this all the time. And yet Paul himself said in 1 Corinthians 9, he said, "Know you not that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain." And sometimes there could be a little bit of confusion there because you would say, well, aren't we all running this together as a church? Well, in one way, yes. But you know that each and every one of us has to work out his own salvation. It's not contingent on what somebody else does. Certainly, we all encourage each other along the way, but this is what Paul was saying, and no doubt he was familiar with these races. He said, "Everyone who strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now, they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we do it for an incorruptible." So they go with all these gold medals. You know, and you know what happens to all these. I mean, I've got a box load of trophies somewhere from all the years of hockey that I played. I've got a gold medal. You know what? It sits in a drawer. In fact, I was wondering this past week as I noticed, I can't remember what the actual portion of gold that there is in the gold medals. There is some, but not very much. I was wondering, I'd like to test my gold medal to see exactly how much gold. I'm almost tempted to sell it. It's just going to sit in that drawer. It really has no meaning. I've got the memories are up here. You know, there are some wonderful memories, wonderful things that I learned about teamwork and other things in all the years that I played sports. So there are some really good things. I mean, even to the time where you can play a game like golf now. You know, I watched some of the best golfers. Now, and on this last trip, I was able to get in 9 holes just off the coast of the east coast of Florida. Beautiful golf course, and one of our elders down there, Mr. Machen, invited me to come on the course that he's a member of there. Just absolutely beautiful. And you see this, it's just absolutely gorgeous. The one thing I like about golf is not just hitting that little ball, but you sometimes go on some beautiful manicured courses, and it's just absolutely gorgeous going out there when you're by yourself and it's peaceful. But you look at these big wide areas that you can hit this little ball. And I just wonder sometimes, why is it with all that wide area that you can hit the ball that so many times it goes into the trees? You just hit it into the trees. And then I watch some of the pro games, and I notice, well, some of these pros hit it into the trees too. The pros hit it into the water. And long ago, I learned about the fact and talked to my dad about this, because dad would get mad and curse when he would hit a bad shot. And I said, Dad, you're not good enough to curse. You are just not good enough. You don't deserve to do that, because naturally we don't play a whole lot and your ball is going to... And he thought about that. You know, something that changed his game. He didn't get so upset all the time. You know, it's a game that you don't need to be getting, nor does anybody need to ever get upset, because they're supposed to be games, aren't they? Even here they call it the Olympic Games. Somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. So there's things that are learned here that Paul was trying to convey to a Christian. Now, I remember hearing years ago, do you remember hearing, we're in the gun lap? You know, and I said, I go, how long does this gun lap last? You know, because it's like you're coming to the finish line. It's the gun lap. You know what happens? They keep moving the tape back. And you're running and they keep moving the tape. And that's what it seems to be like. So all of a sudden, we've got to look at what the scriptures say, because otherwise what happens is people will go on thinking that's going to come, and people have sold their homes. They made some very unwise moves by people told them, well, it's coming, so sell everything you have. Don't get married. Don't continue on with life. And frankly, we had some of those things mentioned where it did seem like it was the end times. So yes, a Christian does plan like it's coming tomorrow, because your life may not last beyond tonight. Any of us could go. But we also live life to the fullest like God wants us to. So there's wisdom to be used when we look at these scriptures. So Paul said, I therefore run, not as uncertainly, so I fight, not as one that beats the air. He knew why he was running the race. He knew what he was doing, and he knew where he was going. And he tried to share that. So he said, I keep under my body, bring it into subjection, lest by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. So yeah, this is almost, when you think about it, we've gone from what's said about a gun lap to like a marathon. So which one is it? And sometimes it really seems like this has been a marathon. And you get tired, don't you? It's almost like we have to stop at those stops and get a drink along the way and then get going again. And basically we have. We've had to stop and get going again. It's almost like we've had to do this even on our trip. We just, after camp, we're tired. Let's go off on this trip. It's like you come up for air and then dive back in it again. And now we're all preparing for the Feast of Tabernacles and all these other programs and things that we're doing. You know, it's really wonderful, but yes, you get tired. And we've got to use wisdom in this. Now, Paul also said in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, see, if we don't have, as I mentioned in the letter I sent, if one does not hold to the vision of our finish line, it's likely that the reward will be lost. Too many have quit the race and have lost the zeal to finish. And we can't let that happen. We can't give it up. And so many have. We have witnesses, and this is what I'd like to talk about today when it comes to the vision aspect of hindsight. We've got a lot of examples that were before us. I've got a family member that came to the church and gave it up. And I know in the future, a lot of people are going to be so sorry that they gave up the reward of which we have ahead of us. Not many receive that reward. And the more we see it, you know, the more we become convicted of it all the time. Very few. Many are called, but very few are chosen. So Paul said, wherefore, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. I mean, it's not a gun with patience. You know, those that are running 100 or 200, it is all out. But those that are running, if you've even seen the half mile, I was watching some of the longer races, and some of these runners have to temper themselves. They can't start out of the blocks too quick, and they know themselves. Some have a faster kick at the end. Some start out quicker, and they know they need to because they won't have that kick at the end. So everybody runs the race a little bit differently. So it says, let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking to Christ. Now here's the hindsight aspect here. The author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the crucifixion. So here's a picture that Christ himself saw. He knew what he would be going through, didn't he? And yet it says, for the joy that was set before him. You know, the greatest thing about what we're going to be having in the future is a time to be able to sit with Christ and to talk to him and to ask him questions. What was it really like? What was that experience? Because I only have some of the testimonies that I see in the Bible that it was so heavy on you that the Bible says it was as drops of blood. This had to be agonizing for you as you went through this. So how do you couple that? How were you able to go through that? And yet in our own lives, we've got different examples of sometimes weights that were on us, and we felt so heavy. Yet God gave us the strength to continue to get up and endure. I look back at some of the past stuff that we went through. I wouldn't want to go through it again. It was so heavy at the time. And yet all the things that we do, we become stronger for it. And we see that God gives us the strength. And we see that the Father gave Christ the strength when he appealed for it the most. That third time when he went and he says, Father, I'm just so heavy. You know, so we go to God maybe one time, you know, and you don't feel the weight. You just feel. So we go again, and we go again, and we go again. And finally, it seems like we get up and it's okay. The trial's still there, but God still gives us the strength and the ability to be able to endure it, just like he did with Jesus Christ. And it's said because Christ knew the plan, didn't he? He knew that had to be done. So we as Christians should also know that the things that happen in our life also have to be done. Because if they didn't, then Christ would remove them from us. We wouldn't have to go through them, but he allows us different experiences. So we can be sharpened too, and we can be ready for his kingdom. So it said he despised the shame and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So you've got two individuals there, one who was Christ, who knew that his race was finished. When he said, when he was hanging there on the stake, and he says, it's finished, it's done. All those, whatever millennial of planning that was going to be done had now come. Could you imagine that? Here's Christ all of a sudden coming to this day, when here's a being that had always existed, finally gets to a place in his existence where he becomes a human being. This was all in the plan, and now he's facing the time where he knew it would be a very painful death. And he said, it's finished. The part that God the Father gave him to do at that time had come to completion. Christ knew that he made it, and he knew there was more to it also. But that part of the plan with him dying as a physical human being has come to the completion. He says, it's finished, and he died. Paul also said, it's finished, didn't he? He says, the race that I've fought the fight, I've finished the course. He knew it. The testimony I get from what Paul said, looking back in hindsight, is every Christian should know when you come to your time, should come to that conclusion. And it should be okay. For the joy that lies before us, this is the preparation we need to be doing. Can we think in our lives now, are we prepared for that time? Oh, you'll never be to the point where you'll be perfect. We already know that. But can we come to the time where whatever happens to us, we said, you know, it doesn't matter. God knows that I've been in the constant state of trying to grow and overcome. I fought my fight. I finished my course. I am ready for the return of Christ. If we're not there now, that's where we need to be. So we see the hindsight, the ability to see after the event what should have been done. It says the perception of the nature of an event after it has happened. And you can always see, imagine the swimmer that just lost by a hand stroke. You could see in his thoughts. I mean, he was looking. I could just see the look on his face, just totally perplexed because he thought he had the race won. You know, when those swimmers are swimming, they have the ability to look and see where their opponent is sometimes. So maybe he thought that he had the race won, and the other guy caught him just by that, and he was just stunned because that was his race. So it's very interesting to look at some of these things. We've heard of the term Monday morning quarterback, haven't we? Because anybody can look and see what should have been done. I love these sports announcers that are always questioning the call of the coach. Well, he should have done that. Well, yeah. Now you can see that. That's easy for you to say. But, you know, I know of no coach that wants to make a bad play. It was just a choice that was made. And then you've got all the critics that come after that, the Monday morning quarterbacks. But we can use this ability for something very positive. And the Bible talks about this. And hindsight is very important in a Christian when you think about it. Otherwise, God would not give us what's called, what's contained in the law about hindsight. Here's the quiz today. What in God's law is a part of what's called hindsight? That's an important part of God's law. Now think about it. You've got, is it the law? Is it judgments? Is it statutes? Is it precepts? What part of law goes back to using hindsight? There's one I'm missing. It's called testimonies. God's law is contained in testimonies. Remember when I went through this aspect before? Testimonies show how God worked. There are incidences in the Bible, and that's why we have, let's go here to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. This is a wonderful instrument which is contained in the part of God's law called the testimonies. And that's why Paul wrote of this in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. This is the testimonies of the people of God. In verse 1, notice what he says here. There's another time where he says this too, that we were able to use this past weekend when I did a funeral over in Chattanooga. For a member of another church, but he asked me because we were longtime friends. And it's interesting when you go and something is being said about what we know that takes the edge off of what even death, the perception of death today. But Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1, I would not that you should be ignorant. He also said that to the Thessalonians, didn't he? I would not that you should be ignorant concerning those who have died. Because people make a big, big thing about it. And it's a part of the plan of God. Do you know what's so interesting when you look even at the scripture? It says, you know this. It's appointed blank for man to die once. And yet you see actually a couple of that have died a couple of times, haven't they? But it is appointed once in the overall plan for man to die. Anybody ever think who appointed that? It says it's appointed. God appointed it. So it doesn't just, it's not something that's just thrown together. This blows away those that think that all of a sudden everything just happened too. There was actually a plan of God that included death. And it's a sad part in life because it hurts in this very temporary time that we're given. When you think about the temporary time we're given, wow. When Mr. Franks was talking about how many years this work in our lifetime has been going. A lot of us look back and go, whatever happened to that? I look at the past week, what happened to that? Or the past day, what happened to that? So many people are saying how fast time is going. But notice this testimony here. He says of how that all our fathers were under the cloud and passed through the sea. Here's a testimony. Yes, God appointed it. He planned that. Once for man to die, and for these things to take place. So Paul is bringing this up as a testimony for some hindsight here. This is a review or a survey or a contemplation of things in the past. We can look at things, we call it in retrospect. Verse 2, and it says, and all were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Now, was this a real baptism? No, it wasn't. So we can see that God has worked in different ways. This was a type. They were baptized unto Moses. Moses was leading them. They went through the Red Sea. They weren't baptized. I mean, first of all, we normally ask how many people repent. How many of the Israelites repented? Well, we could see a testimony of that. I don't think any of us needs to be a brain surgeon to see how few of the Israelites even got it. But it says they all ate that same spiritual meat. They were taught the same thing. And they all drank of the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. And that rock was Christ. But with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were written for our example, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Now you got to bring this up to modern day times. What is it possible that we could lust after? That's an examination, because it's written here not for a waste of time. So we would have to examine in our lives things that we might lust after. Let's go back and holding our place here. Let's go back to Numbers chapter 11 and verse 4. Numbers 11, verse 4. Hold your place, though, because we're going to come back there to 1 Corinthians. Let's see what happened here in retrospect and in hindsight, and what problem that came here. Because for as long as most of us have been in the church, you know, we'll be in Santa Rosa this year. Maybe I brought this up already, but they call it wine country. So I tease people and I say, we're going to go do all of our whining in Santa Rosa this year. It's wine country. So we'll whine and complain and be murmurers there. And I hear it's beautiful, the Napa Valley. We look forward to seeing that. But, you know, there was, when you look upon it, there was a lot of whining that the children of Israel did, didn't they? But I remember that in our lifetime, too. You know, you bring that perspective up to modern day times. Did you ever hear or maybe caught up with it? We're going, well, how come we're having a feast site over there? Don't they know that this and this and this and this? One specifically I remember some years ago was Orlando. Why do we have that feast site in Orlando? Don't they know that those people are just going to go to Disney World? So yeah, if I went to Disney World, yeah, it's just going to be, wow, look, we get to go to Disney World and forget about the feast. And we had one minister, I remember when he told me, he said, Eric, he goes, I was looking for a place in the panhandle of Florida. And frankly, he found a place that he could have used and he could have signed up for that site. But he said, something was just telling me. It was not this voice, it was just some kind of inspiration that was saying, don't get the feast site there. Something came up in his mind, so he signed up for Orlando. And that year, hurricane came in and wiped out Fort Walton Beach. They would have had no feast site there. So it's interesting what God does to choose to place his name there. And after I thought about that, as I've mentioned to you before, I mentioned, you know, do you ever think that there is a group of the ministers? I know there's quite a few that are involved with that committee of selecting the feast sites. And I don't know of any time we're knowing these men that they would say, you know, we've got some good feast sites. We've got Colorado. We've got, you know, we've got one down in Texas. We've got one in Florida. Let's find one that just is a trial for the people. Let's find a miserable site this year. You know, and when you think about it, you go, yeah, that is kind of ridiculous. So how could we even say, well, how come they're choosing this one this year? How come they chose Dayton and we went to the Dayton, Ohio feast site? Many of you knew it as the resort area, and we called it the last resort. But you know something? And we teasingly said that because it's where God's people were. And it was a good, I don't remember looking back at Dayton and go, that's a feast site I have in memory. That's definitely one of my worst feasts ever. Because I don't know if I had a worst feast ever. I know most of us had best feasts ever. But when we think about that and think about the mindset that we can get into sometimes, we can fall into the same trap in retrospect, looking and seeing, oh, there might have been different things. We sure aren't lusting after meat. In one way, are we? We've got all kinds of meat. In fact, that's one of our problems when we get to the feast. You're going to order a steak. I make better steaks at my house than I get out. We can get all different steaks many times. In fact, you can go, you don't know what you're getting at the restaurant. Are they hand-selected that don't have the hormones in them? But you can go pick one of those out at Earth Fair or some other place. So you can actually have better steaks during the year. That's how blessed we are. And that's how more thankful we should be. So here they fell into a trap here. in verse 4 of Numbers 11, the mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting. And no doubt that attitude just spread. Did you hear about that? Yeah. And all of a sudden you get what I call the bonanza syndrome. Everybody's lighting their torches and they want to find somebody to hang. Who shall give us flesh to eat? And it was so ridiculous that they were actually weeping. They were crying about it. We remember the fish which we ate in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlics. And somebody would say, yeah, but did you remember being whipped? Did you remember being in oppression? Did you remember not having the freedoms that you've got right now? This is really the mindset and the trap they fell into. But now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all besides this manna. Can you believe this? Besides this manna. And you know, then it describes it. So here it is for a testimony. Let's not read over this so quickly because there was a huge problem here. Do you mean that you're going to get a gift from God and say, well, he just gives us this manna? And we could have had garlic and leeks, and that's all we have now. So he describes it. Manna was as coriander seed, and the color thereof is the color of bellium. See, coriander is not just a spice used in cooking, but it has many medicinal values, and it actually promotes healing. So isn't it interesting that God gave them something that had absolute, you know, not having tasted manna, I would have to guess that God is probably the best cook in the universe. You know, if something is going to taste good, I'll imagine something coming from God is going to be probably one of the best tasting things you could ever have. So it says, they went about, they gathered it and ground it into mills, beat it into mortar, baked it in pans, made cakes of it, made casseroles that we would do. You know, they used their heads and they made all different things just like we do today. And the taste of it was as the taste of fresh oil. Now, many of us have probably had not fresh oil. And we've had, even sometimes we'll get the extra virgin, they call it olive oil. That's still processed. So I wondered sometimes, what does fresh squeezed oil right from the tree really taste like? It must taste pretty good when it's ready to go. Taste was a fresh oil. So from God, would it not be like the best someone would ever taste? And when the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell upon it. And Moses heard the people weep through their families, every man in the door of his tent. And the anger of the Lord was greatly kindled. Moses was also displeased. So now looking at this verse, hopefully we can more understand why God was so angry. I've given you a gift and you despise it. You call it just this manna? How would some of the women here like to spend weeks preparing the most wonderful dish you ever did? And somebody would say, well, I like the hamburger at Wendy's a little bit better. That's a slam. I mean, that was an insult to God, and it was taken so. So these are the people that we're dealing with here. So, but how, bringing it to today, how can we lust after things today? See, isn't this a now society? Are we not a debt-ridden society that we want something and we want it now, even if it violates the principles of God, that we go into debt to get it? And we advertise that. You know, why wait, the commercial says, when you can have it now? And you get people that camp out at Best Buy for the newest games to come by, so they can give it to their kids or play it themselves and spoil their kids. You want it? I'll get it for you. I'm going to be the first one, and we'll camp out for you to get this. That's how important this is. It's become silly and sad to see a nation that lusts after the newest computer game that comes out, that doesn't even know the four faces of Mount Rushmore, but they know Snap, Crackle, and Pop. So verse 7, it says, neither be idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. So how can we be idolaters today? Does it literally take a physical image? Or could it be football? Could it be golf? Do you know there are people that cry when their team loses? There are people that messes up their entire week or their entire day if their football team loses. I mean, they are miserable. Do you know, should not a Christian take a look at that and go, why should this make me mad? Frankly, why should I even rejoice? As years ago, I took a look at my team, the Detroit Red Wings, where I was born from. So, of course, you have this affinity for the team that's near you. We move so much, it's hard to have that affinity sometimes. So you got the Detroit Red Wings, and I watched it one time after they finally, after many years of not winning anything, they won the covetous Stanley Cup. And I saw the men on the team. Detroit Red Wings. Nobody was from Detroit. Nobody was from Michigan. Very few were from the United States. Kozlov, Larionov, Chekhov, Holmstrom, Lindstrom. That's my team? They're not even from Detroit. And so it stops. You kind of get a perspective. What in the world am I cheering for? A name? Jersey? And what's the importance of it? By the way, who won the Stanley Cup? Even this year, does anybody know? I don't even know. I can't remember. If I sat long enough to think about it, I might. But so what? It really doesn't matter. And yet we've got people that kill themselves and kill a referee. Some of the soccer games you've seen overseas, they've killed the referees because the call hasn't gone their way. And it really comes down to really, can the people of God get all bent out of shape if your sports team doesn't win? It's time to think about what perspective and what race that we're running, isn't it? But this actually happens. And it's okay to talk about it and to think about our perspective. In hindsight, we sure don't want that to happen to us. So that's going back to 1 Corinthians 10, by the way, being idolaters. Verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 10, it says, neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day, 23,000. You know, considering this Greek word, porneo, or porn you, as it's rendered in verse 8, does it help us to see which is one of the most grievous sins confronting our society today? You know what a huge burden on our society today is? Porn. And for some reason, I knew it years ago when the internet was coming on into play. I said, this can be a wonderful tool, but it can be a real bad one too. It can gossip can spread faster than it can before, and porn is available just like that. You can see something, and that it's become an addiction to the point where it's perverted everything that God made to be good. And it's a huge problem, possibly even among our church. Verse 9, it says, neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. So let's go back to, in hindsight, to a testimony here in Numbers chapter 21 and verse 4. Keep your finger there. Again, we'll come back to 1 Corinthians. But let's go to Numbers 21, and let's begin in verse 4 to see this, because that's why it's written. It's important for us to take a look at this aspect of the Bible. And neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them tempted, were destroyed of the serpents. We go to Numbers 21, verse 4. They journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, and the souls of the people were discouraged because of the way. What does that bring up in your mind? Does that click anything in your mind right now as far as a modern-day scenario? They were discouraged because of the way. Do you know, I always have not liked the way that we've gone. Have you? Do you like to go to a way that's filled with divisions and breakups in the church? Have we not become discouraged sometimes because of the way? And yet I've had to sit back in perspective and go, you know, I can look back now in hindsight and see of how some things had to happen. Because people were clinging on to and saying things such as, I'll never leave the church. What do you mean by that? See, all of a sudden, the church becomes an item that's a whole different perspective. I've heard people say before, well, the church teaches this. And I've told my wife, I'm the church, and I don't teach that. So why don't we say what we mean by what we say? The words are important to God. So exactly what is the church? And some would say, some actually clung to an organization, as we know, because they felt, well, God will take, and maybe some of us said, God will take care of that. And we look back later on and go, yeah, he did, but not in the way that we thought. And that's why I tell you, and I'll tell you again, things that will be happening in the future probably will be a lot different than when we think in our minds. Because every time we try to nail something down that we is a private interpretation, we end up eating that little plate of crow. Doesn't taste so good, and that's unclean. Because Isaiah says, for as heaven is high as the earth, so are my thoughts and my ways. So we have to look at what we're looking toward, what's most important in our lives, and what really has the meaning in the race that we're running. So because of the way, many people have been discouraged and have left the church, the body of Christ, as a result of being disillusioned that the way that they thought wasn't maybe in a mindset with the direction that they had in mind. It would be so much easier if we always just stayed together with one group. Really? How many lessons would be learned about the truth? And the people spoke against God, it says, and against Moses. Wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there's no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loathes this light bread. You've got to be kidding me. Do you see what they just said? Our soul loathes it? This was not a slap in the face to God. And so God sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died. Do you remember the time where God said, I've had it? How many people would look at this and God said, I had it? Moses then pleads with God, no, please don't start it up through me. And God changed his mind. But it was very close. And God could have done it that way. Verse 10 of 1 Corinthians 10 says, neither murmur you, as some have also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. And there's always been something to murmur about, isn't there? Never that we can't deal with issues, I'll point out, by the way, because if some has an issue that is brought up, and it's brought up in the right way, I've never had any problem with that. I know that some have brought up questions before, maybe to a ministry that says, well, you just got a bad attitude. And I thought about that because I've experienced the same thing. No, I don't have a bad attitude. I just don't agree with you respectfully on what we're saying. So there's nothing wrong with bringing up the topic. But there's murmuring that's taking place all around. You know, when it comes to lighting, when it's come to heat, when it's come to sound, it's the easiest things to murmur about, really. So I'll say, guess what? If it's hot, let's turn it down. If it's cold, let's turn it up. The problem is sometimes we've got people that are too cold and too hot, and it's like the three bears. So what do we do? It's a hard conclusion to come to, isn't it? And this really does happen sometimes. But let's put our heads together and figure it out. How do we get by? I've been at feasts before that somebody says, sound is way too loud. So where are you sitting? About where Mrs. Waddle is to the big speaker. I say, by the way, the seat there is more for the hard of hearing. So if you would like to sit in another place, you probably aren't going to get the sound, because if they turn off the sound, I'm thinking this has got to be common sense, but somehow it's not always there. So there's someone there to always like test maybe my attitude then. You finally get to think about, oh, I tell you, you know, what are we going to do about this? You can take some breaths of air in. Say it's the Feast of Tabernacles, everything's going to be okay, let's deal with it. One person said, all those seats are taken up by ushers. I said, really? I was in the office and came out and looked at it and go, well, there were a lot of usher seats. There were a lot of usher seats. And one time there was five in a row. And I said, you know, I know we print out usher seats, but to kind of save money and time, we don't say usher and then usher's wife and then usher's son and usher's daughter and usher's baby. We just say usher, and hopefully people will understand that's the family of the ushers. So, and that, yes, the usher has to take an end seat because they serve the people and need to get out quickly. And you would think you wouldn't have to really explain all that. But it just seems some people, whatever for whatever reason, have something that they want to complain about. And so what I'm saying is, in retrospect, we can learn that maybe mistakes that we made and say, you know, I don't want to do that. And it doesn't mean, by the way, you've got to hold your tongue and never say anything. If there's a problem, we can always address an issue or a problem. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just how our temperament is. Are we short-tempered? Does our patience run out on us? And that does happen sometimes, and we can actually fall into the part of murmuring. Some could even say coming up to the feast or a sermon message. Well, I really didn't like that one today. I really didn't like, well, you know, that's fine. But I don't think the guy got up and said, I want to give something that nobody likes today. You know, I'm tired of giving good sermons. I want to give one and just make people miserable and cause them to fall asleep. No one gets up with the planning attempt to do that, but that's sometimes how we can react to it. So I say before the feast, let's pray for every message that's given. And if we haven't done our part in praying for that, then we're probably not going to get anything out of it. Because even the smallest thing, the smallest tidbit, could hit us in a different way for a message if we're in tune with it. But if we're in tune to, well, you know, here this guy is again, or here that guy is, and then we get back to murmur, the old ancient Israelite. And again, this is what this is for. So Numbers 14, verse 26 brings this out. Numbers 14, 26. Here it says, the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, how long will I bear with this evil congregation who murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings. Do you notice what it says here as a testimony? When God says he hears the murmurings, if we murmur, God hears it. You know, you can't whisper to somebody and God not hear it. So by the way, what you just tried to whisper as a murmur, God heard it. He said, as I truly live, you have spoken, as you have spoken in my ears, I will do to you. Your carcasses will fall in the wilderness. And all who are numbered of you, according to your number, from 20 years old and upward, who have murmured against me, doubtless you will not come into the land concerning which I swore to make you dwell, except for Caleb and Joshua. Do you know, so once again, we have in retrospect or in hindsight, how few make it. Bring it up to modern day times, telling you how few make it. I believe that there are very few that will actually become first fruits. Based on the testimonies and the witness of God, and based on, in hindsight, what I've seen from all the areas that I've gone to where thousands of people gather together on God's Sabbath and his holy days. And it just keeps getting more scattered and very few, and the tests are upon the people of God. And that's how important it is for us to see and be reminded of this, so we can cling on to it, so we can hold on, which we have, and never get tired. Because if we're fighting a spiritual battle, like Paul says, then that means that Satan's going to come after us in different ways, sometimes that we may not expect, sometimes in ways that we may not see. We've got to be aware of this and avoid falling into these pitfalls and traps that happened to the Israelites. We can't say, well, that was then. Yes, it was then. But it's written in hindsight as a testimony, which is a part of God's law, so that doesn't happen to us. Verse 31, it says, but your little ones, which you said should be a prey, those will I bring in, and they will know the land which you despised. So they were going to be able to see in hindsight what their parents did that didn't make it. They did not make it. As for you, your carcasses, they will fall in this wilderness, and your children will wander in the wilderness for 40 years and bury your whoredoms until your carcasses are wasted in the wilderness. After the number of days in which you search the land, even 40 days, each day for a year, will you bear your iniquities. And 40 years, you will know the breach of your promise. So they were going to have to see what they did. And they were going to have to live with that. I, the Lord, have said, I will surely do all this evil to all this evil congregation that are gathered together against me in this wilderness. They will be consumed, and there they will die. And the men whom Moses sent to search the land, who returned and made the congregation to murmur against him by bringing up a slander upon the land, even those men who did bring up the evil report upon the land, died by the plague before the Lord. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were of the men that went to search the land, lived. And those that make the slanderous statements as they do now, even upon any of God's servants or God's people, will be called into account for what they have said. So nobody gets away with it, by the way. The slander that you can go on the website now and see, slander against Mr. Armstrong, they will be called into account for that kind of murmuring. You know, could you imagine what will be done in the future? There's going to be a resurrection. Mr. Armstrong's there. God will go, you got something to say against my servant? Where'd you get your information from? Who gave it to you to make that kind of a judgment? And people are going to be doing Ralph Cramden. Hama, hama, hama. They're not going to know what to say. They will be held into account for this, and we cannot be caught into that kind of murmuring. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians 10 and beginning in verse 11, because it once again says here, these things happen to them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world have come. That we don't fall. So what we don't do is take these examples back in Numbers and other areas so lightly as just some kind of Bible stories. They are written for us. And that's what Paul says. So the warning comes out in verse 12. Wherefore, him that thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. Oh, you think you got this down now, huh? God goes, really? Okay. And that's good. If you think you've got that down, then God goes, no, I take you up to step two. I take you up to step this one. And then he tests us to see where we stand. We will all be tested. He says in verse 13, there's no trial that's come upon you, but is such as common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tried above what you are able, but will, with the temptation, with the trial, make a way to escape, that you can handle it. So he knows, our teacher knows exactly, he's not going to give us something that we can't handle. Or what we don't know. You go back to the testimony of Abraham, which I brought up long ago. He didn't start Abraham out, did he? With the first thing. Here's Abraham. Go sacrifice your only son. He didn't start Abraham out with a trial like that. We can see in testimonies that he had Abraham move from the land. That was hard enough right there for him. Then you go to the next one where he tells him, I'm going to give you a son from a woman who's can't bear, really? And then he takes him along a path to finally he takes Abraham to a trial that how many here would be able to bear that? When we see what really you're gonna do this, and you know, and Abraham never doubted. He knew that God would fulfill his promise, but you're probably thinking this is where we get to talk to Abraham. Abraham, what was that like? You know, they do it in the movies, but what was it really like? I mean, were you thinking, I'm clueless here. I have no idea. But one thing I do have established is I'm not going to doubt God. I don't know, nor do I understand why he's saying what he's saying. He just followed through with it. But that was not easy. That was very difficult. But God knew and brought him to a point where he tested him. But he made a way of escape. Now, in conclusion here, Luke chapter 9, verse 62. This is not a contradiction that I want to bring up here. Because Jesus said in Luke chapter 9, verse 62, he said, no man having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom. We've got hindsight. We've got testimonies that we do look upon. In fact, many here will probably call what I call, I just mentioned to my kids, don't go to stupid school and take the same class twice. We all go through it. All of us have gone, wish I wouldn't have done that. Wish I wouldn't have made that move. And I just think, okay, don't take the same class twice. None of us have totally graduated from it yet, because we're going to continue to go through the school and we're going to learn and grow. And that can be okay. You know, and that's why I thought, isn't that why in Proverbs it says to the child, listen to the wisdom of your mom and dad, because they've already taken the classes. And now really our appeal is, please don't do that. Please don't make those same mistakes. And we fall into the same trap where the kids go, well, you know, I've got to choose my own way. I've got to do that. We've got all the hindsight in retrospect that our kids don't yet have. And that's why Proverbs is there for the kids to go, listen. Listen to the wisdom of your mom and dad. They've been through that. They've done that before. Listen to what they have to say. What they have to say is wisdom. But Luke 9:62 is simply explaining what the Israelites did. Oh, I wish I could go back to that. I sure wish I had my leaks. You know, I tell you what, if God didn't call me, everything would be going peachy clean now. I wouldn't go through this entire mess in the church. Oh, really? Like we wouldn't have any other trials in life? What we go through now, at least we know that God has a plan for us. At least I know whatever I go through, I'm not just falling into something. That God either says, yes, I'm going to allow him to go through this, or he's going to divert and prevent me from going through it. But whatever, if I know I'm going to go through it, at least it's in the plan of God that he's working and helping, and we're growing and we're following and running that race individually and, yes, together as a church. So that's looking back for the wrong reasons and losing the vision of looking ahead, which is another aspect of our vision. Let's look at this, though, and take this seriously as we look, because it's not always an aspect that we look at within the church. We usually see vision as an aspect of going forward. This is a critical aspect because, as you know and I've explained, it's contained in the law of testimonies. It's for our example that we don't fall into the same pitfall twice. So remember hindsight, and let's use it wisely.